A couple of recent national surveys made headlines with findings suggesting some change in the relationship between religion and culture in this country. There's also been some other religion-oriented news that you might have missed over the summer months. So to look at both the surveys and the headlines, I'm delighted to be joined again by the Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, Executive Religion Editor for the Huffington Post, good friend. Paul, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
What are some of the religion stories from recent months that just come to the front of your brain right off?
When I think about the last few months, one of the biggest stories, of course, was Ferguson. And one of the, I would say, underreported stories was the role that clergy and religious people played from the very beginning. I talked to some people who were there the first night that protests started. Clergy were there. They were praying at a prayer, interfaith prayer service that happened the day after the event. And they were in the front lines and sometimes actually were experiencing the violence of the police themselves. And they were also a real liaison sometimes because they also, some of them knew the police. And so they were able to foster conversations. We think of these interfaith groups or these, you know, clergy, and you kind of think, oh, yeah, well, they're doing their thing. When a crisis happens, and the other example I think of is Newtown, the shooting there, all of a sudden, people turn to the clergy. And especially in this case, the clergy put themselves on the line with the people. And it was a beautiful thing and very powerful witness to the courage of clergy and also, hopefully, the healing power of clergy. And it wasn't just clergy, I should say. It was really religious leaders. And I would say the mainstream media, or many of us might not immediately think of, such as the Nation of Islam, as well as Jewish. I talked to a rabbi who said they had, it's from an interracial congregation. So it wasn't just that they were coming in out of solidarity. It was their own community members who live there who, you know, said, we need to be there. So there was all sorts of good things that happened. It also reminds me of a program that has just started in Rochester called the Clergy Patrol, where they also have a somewhat fraught relationship between the community and the police. The Clergy Patrol are 100 members of the clergy who go out on patrol with the police in order to foster positive relations. And I think that if we can see more kind of pragmatic ways that religious people, people of faith of all kinds, can get out there and be a resource to the community of healing and hope and reconciliation, that's what we should all be about.
I can't help but ask you, do you think we're making progress with interreligious relations?
Well, it makes me think of the other story that was so big this summer, which is the Gaza war. Israel and Gaza went to war, and it represented to me a certain fragility of our interfaith conversations because there was no conversation. People really could not talk about it. Jewish and Christians, Jews and Muslims who knew each other well could not find even the language to talk about it. And it made me think, well, maybe we really need to be a little harder in our discipline with one another. How do we really have the conversations? By the way, Jews have a hard time talking with other Jews about this issue. So this is not just an interreligious question. This is an intra-religious question as well. That said, it made me wonder, like, where are some of the major interfaith groups that we turn to? They were very, very silent about it. They just could not find a way even to have a productive conversation. So I think in many ways, our interfaith groups are very strong. I mean, there's the kind of a new moment in the climate change march. For instance, there were clergy all over the place, and it was really a fun, positive environment. It showed you. But it's the hard stuff. And I hope that somehow we can learn from that and figure out ways to be in community and dialogue with one another in hard moments like that.
You know, Paul, when I came to this job at the Interfaith Alliance, one of my first major disappointments was seeing a situation in which people who were totally in sync in interfaith dialogue about domestic issues could not handle international issues. And I've even had people try to make the case to me that they are involved in interreligious dialogue on domestic issues because they can't be involved in interreligious dialogue on international issues.
I don't really buy that, I have to say. I think it's something that either you have a heart for conversation with people with whom you don't agree on some fundamental questions of theology, you have to be able to talk about everywhere. And the reason it's so hard is that it's so close to people's hearts. Everybody was feeling defensive. Everybody was feeling vulnerable. Everybody was feeling under attack. And those are the moments that we have to be able to rise to respect one another, to feel one another's pain. One thing that happened at the beginning of New York University's school year, they held an event, the rabbi, the imam, and other religious leaders held an event where students were able to talk uninterrupted, and everyone would be silent, just listening to them. It went on for about an hour and a half, and it was just people talking about the summer and how hard it had been. Ferguson, Israelis, Gazans, you know, people from all over the world were able just to say, this is why this hurt, and other people just listened. And for me, that was a start. That was actually a very powerful start. And from there, we can take it to maybe having a constructive conversation about how we can come together to heal.
You are in a very interactive situation with the Huffington Post. What religion subjects have generated the most reader response for you?
It really depends. Sometimes it's breaking news that is very, very good, very exciting, and people want to know about it. For instance, today, Jimmy Carter said something very favorable, you know, in a question and answer. He said, Jesus never discriminated against anyone, and we shouldn't discriminate against LGBT people. That has done very well for us. On the other hand, ISIS is very interesting to people. Muslims especially really want to talk about ISIS. So we have had a couple different stories, very different in their tenor. One of them was about the 100 Muslim scholars who came together and wrote a very, very strong Quranically based theological response to Islamic State and basically blasting them for not understanding theology, not understanding Islam. This was not a liberal group, by the way. It's not the kind of theology that more liberal Muslims would appreciate, but it is a fundamentally strong argument, a refutation completely. That has done extremely well. Likewise, something that was just happening on Twitter, which was a hashtag called Muslim Apologies, which was these Muslims who were like, okay, there's a few thousand people in Iraq and Syria who are really messing things up, and there are a billion of us who are expected to apologize for it. So these very, you know, Twitter savvy, funny people were like apologizing for, like, you know, the halal food was cold when it arrived on your plate, things like that. Very funny, you know, Muslim apologies. So we've been covering this from different angles, and all of those stories have been doing well because, of course, Muslims are very passionate about this issue.
Yeah. A recent Pew poll showed 72% of Americans saying religion is losing influence in public life, and most of them say it's a bad thing. The same survey discovered a growing number, nearly half of respondents, saying churches should play a bigger role in culture and politics. Does that surprise you?
It does surprise me. I think that the numbers are slightly skewed towards evangelical Christians who really strongly feel this lack of influence and would like to have more freedom in the pulpit to talk about political, electoral ideas. I have to say that many in the liberal church would, you know, hear that and do that as well. So we shouldn't be hypocritical about it. We should recognize that this is happening. People are talking about politics. The question about whether or not more people want religion in public life, I'm not sure exactly how that was phrased, because it goes against a lot of the ideas of us becoming a more secular country, more nones, and an actual fatigue of people hearing about how God feels about our personal lives and things like that. What I think it does indicate on some level is an unease, an essential unease of the direction of the country, and a wish for something that can ground us in something real, maybe some sense of our more positive, greatest generation past. And so I think that that can be a nostalgia that makes sense to me. But as far as the real bigger trend, people being more interested in religion that is out there for the individual, but is not actually influencing the way we are together as a society, which could be actually a bad thing. I mean, if we didn't have the history of, say, the social gospel or the civil rights movement, those were strongly religiously influenced movements. And so we want to remember that this is a double-edged sword. Let's try to figure out where our morality will come from and tap into that, the best of it, from all different sources, secular and religious.
The Pew poll finds public support for marriage equality dipping 5% from earlier this year to 49%. The same change in the percentage of respondents who think homosexuality is a sin. That number is now at 50%. Have you seen anything that might confirm this admittedly small shift?
I have no idea, honestly. I was kind of shocked by that. Young people and more secular people are clearly, you know, embracing the full equality of LGBT people. And yet there is a segment of society that may become more entrenched against the idea of full equality before we actually move on to full equality. I think they feel it's part of this sense of being under attack. Our values are under attack. I think it's something that gay rights activists should be very aware of and figure out, well, how do we continue to talk to people about who we are, about why our lives matter, how we actually just want the same thing as everybody else? I think that that will continue to move the needle. And I think long term, we're going to see an overwhelming acceptance within the next 10 to 15 years.
Yet another survey, Duke University's National Congregation Study, shows a 10% jump in faith communities accepting lesbian and gay members, although the overall acceptance number is still only 48%. Of course, that's going to vary widely across denominations. I see, and I think I hear you seeing, a trend of acceptance.
Well, we've also seen not just a trend of acceptance, but we've seen denominations change their laws to allow for gay people to be ordained, gay ministers to be married, things like that. So it's not just around a broad sort of abstract acceptance. It's really written into the books, which is a powerful change and hard to do in denominations. You know, that's not nothing. And so I think that it is important to recognize the gains that continue to be made. One thing that struck me about that last survey was that Catholic support had actually gone down. We asked the author of that report at Duke, and he said, you know, it's become a very salient issue for the Catholic Church. For instance, especially with Catholic schools, should they be allowed to fire gay people? This is happening a lot. People are being forced to take sides in concrete terms in a way that maybe they hadn't been 10 years ago. But what I think eventually, again, we're going to see this going forward, and it may never reach 100%. But I think as long as there's a tipping point, my hope is that very soon we will break 50% and get up to 60 and 70%, where we just really recognize that gay people are human people. And this is just going to be a part of our, hopefully, our families and our friends and the human community, and not kept on the outside of the circle any longer.
I think what you've just said certainly impacts the other one I was going to mention. It's also from Pew that dramatically more LGBT persons identify as non-religious, 48%, than the general population. I think I could understand that. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think in that same poll, actually, there's a more of a sense of in the middle. The question they ask is, are you strongly religious or are you strongly atheist? For the strongly religious, they are much less. But if you're a moderate, you see almost identical numbers of LGBT and non-LGBT identifying as moderately religious. This is a very blatant and open, making a case for more moderate, more open-minded, more progressive religion. If you have your mind open to the changing way that religion and spirituality is practiced in day-to-day life and are not so dogmatic that you are looking towards the past for all the answers instead of recognizing this spirit could be moving right now, then you're more likely to be open to the idea that, oh, those are my neighbors who I never thought they could be my neighbors. And that's part of the interfaith movement as well. We are open to the other in a different way than we would have been 100 years ago. It's progress, and it's important, and it should be a fundamental, essential idea of what it means to be a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim in the 21st century. And so we can't be bashful about that. We can't be bashful about the authentic nature of these kind of religious faith traditions, the more progressive, open, constantly evolving and widening the circle at every opportunity.
I can't be in an election year and have you here in front of me and not ask you, how are we doing in this election year with the delicate balance between religion and politics?
I honestly think that there has been a lot less religion in this midterm, in part just because it's not really in the front of the news. I mean, maybe on very local races that is happening and people are identifying as one thing or not as another. But I don't think we've seen a kind of concerted rallying of, anyone. You know, it doesn't seem like that's out there. I think that there are people who are voting on important issues. Maybe Latinos feel somewhat abandoned by the White House, although I'm not sure, but I think it's more issues. And I don't think anybody's rallying around the cross and the flag right now, anyway.
The Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch is executive religion editor at the Huffington Post. He's the former associate dean of religious life and the chapel at Princeton University, and he is a sought-after commentator and public speaker. You understand why. Paul, I always value your insights and enjoy the discussion, and I really appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It was so great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.